Hello and welcome to the Primary PE Huddle podcast, brought to you by Aspire Active Education. I'm Dan Hayes and I'm going to take you through this episode with our special guest. Aspire Active Education is a passionate family who all believe that PE, sport and physical activity are essential for children to develop a love of healthy living and to end physical inactivity forever. We've proven that working in collaboration with school leadership teams, PE subject leaders, teachers and all PE practitioners positively impacts the sustainability of schools embedding a powerful physical curriculum and essentially helps more children be more active more often. Through this podcast series, we aim to discover the power behind PE, school sport and physical activity in primary schools, the impact this has on the whole school, the impact it has on pupils' holistic development and the secrets behind the successful implementation of a powerful physical curriculum. This is what makes up the Primary PE Huddle. We won't be alone through this journey. We are joined by PE subject leaders, school and academy senior leadership teams, and experts in the field of primary education, who share what physical activity means to them, how they use it as a tool to positively impact children and young people, and what they believe in the Primary PE Huddle. Our guests perform a deep dive on topics such as creating sustainable, high-quality PE, the benefits of physical activity, a top-down collaboration to embed a physically active ethos, and sharing of best practice from their own experiences to create an enthusiastic culture towards a healthy and active lifestyle. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your pods. So, welcome back, everyone. Thanks very much for tuning in for another episode of the Prime PE Huddle. We're really fortunate today to have Bryn with us. Bryn's got an extensive career within the education sector, as well as successfully driving physically active learning, which is the reason we've got him on this episode. It's fantastic to have you, Bryn. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity to join you.
No, not a problem at all. Not a problem. Really looking forward to getting some hidden gems out of you, and I'm sure our listeners are as well. But before we dive into that, would you mind giving yourself the best possible introduction? Because I won't do it justice, as I never do.
Okay, then. My name is Bryn Llewellyn. I used to be a primary teacher, a male in a primary school. In those days, you'd become the PE lead by default. And then it was a case of deputy head and then acting head. Didn't like that too much, so went back to becoming a deputy head teacher. After a while, got a little bit disenfranchised with the way that education system was going, so created Tagtivate. Tagtivate, for those of you who don't know, is a combination between the ultimate playground game, TIG, or TAG, depending on where you live in the world, and Scrabble, or Countdown. So introducing English and maths, embedding English and maths through physical activity. As well as that, I realized that you can't do everything on your own. So it's a case of faster alone, further together, according to Ryan Ellis. So I formed a community interest company called Move and Learn with Ian Holmes and a few others. So this is what I do now. I go around schools, I train teachers up, and hopefully share some love or some of my love for moving and learning.
Brilliant. Fantastic. So as I mentioned, a vast experience there from the teaching side of things to senior management in schools, as well as Tagtivate and Move and Learn and focus on the physically active learning side of things. You mentioned you became disenfranchised with the way the education system was going. I've got to pick up on that. I've got to pick up on it. What were the main things for you that were really the bugbears that made you want to step away in the way you did?
Okay. So, yeah, I originally wanted to become a teacher because I was young and idealistic and wanted to change the world. As a teenager, I was very much into environmental activism and addressing inequalities. So I was a keen member of Greenpeace campaign for nuclear disarmament, Friends of the Earth. So, yeah, I was a bit of a tree hugger, for want of a better term. Brown rice and woolly socks. So I decided that to change the world, it was through education. So I became a teacher. And then, lo and behold, we had this whole raft of national curriculum foisted upon us. And it was a case of that that environmental message, the love of environmental education, was pushed to one side in the pursuit of standards. So, yeah, so we were in a fortunate position that we were working with creative partnerships, and we had this vast sum of money to bring in artists, dramatists, musicians, filmmakers, and it was just a blast. We certainly made the learning irresistible, not just for the children and families, but for the colleagues around us. When that pot of funding disappeared, it was a case of, we now have to do pupil progress meetings, and yet more pupil progress meetings. And I looked upon it in terms of all I was doing was getting children to pass SATs, whether or not it was Key Stage 1, Key Stage 2, or phonics screening. That's all I was doing.
So with the drama and the history and music and everything you mentioned there, how was the teaching different with those than when the pot of money went? What was the key difference there, and why was it so engaging?
I think with creative partnerships, we were allowed to bring in adults other than teachers, and I think there was those people that opened the eyes of the children to think, whoa, you could actually get a job in a creative industry. Likewise, we were working with families who were second, third generation unemployment, and by working with artists, and they were talking about sketchbooks and processes, etc., we were able to like raise their aspirations as well. So I definitely think that the way that many schools have had to go down in recent years is down the English and maths only route. But that might not excite all children, and we have to look at those other opportunities, whether or not it's in STEM subjects or art subjects, and we have to look to that broader and balanced curriculum opportunity.
Yeah, and touching on the fact that the funding went and everything changed, it's quite poignant with regards to the PE and sport premium, and that's everyone's concern that when that goes, actually, is there going to be any impact? Is it all just going to completely go and flop from what people have been putting in place? Is there anything you think we can learn or from that previous funding and why that wasn't sustainable, why it didn't have an impact after it had gone? Or do you think things are being done differently this time and it could be more sustainable?
I think with the creative partnership stuff, that was just purely down to austerity measures. No matter what impact it was having on children and families, it was down to austerity. We've had the PE premium for, 10 years now or thereabouts? And I think I look back to when I was the PE lead in a primary school, there was no such thing as PE and sport premium funding. We just did everything in amongst everything. So there was no funding to bring in external providers. We did everything in-house. And don't get me wrong, it was hard work, but we did it because we had a love of PE at the time, and we would do the display boards and we would organise the competitions and take the children to the different events. But it was all done, I don't know, maybe before this big push on SATs, when teachers maybe had a little bit more time on their hands.
Yeah, and because you mentioned before about the fun of teaching, when things were back then, when things were different, the fun, and then everything came in with regards to data-driven, performance-driven, focus on SATs. Do you think that is what sapped out some of the fun mindset towards things like PE, sport, and competitions? Because sometimes it can be seen as that's that extra thing that's taking up my time.
Yeah, I think. If you look back to the way things have been in terms of look at previous ministers of state for education, the past five, six that we've had, most of those went to public schools. So they don't really necessarily have an appreciation of what it's like to work and learn in a state school. And I do think there is a disjoint between their experiences and the experiences of the majority of the people in the UK.
Yeah, so that is obviously a common argument, but point with regards to those in power making these decisions don't understand what's going on the ground in the schools. So looking more on the ground in the schools, because it sounds like you've got a range of experiences of what teaching was actually like across your career. And the first question I always like to put to people is, what do you wish you knew before going into teaching PE in primary schools? But I don't know if that would be the case back then. It sounds like you actually enjoyed doing it. Or was there something that you wish someone told you right before?
Don't get me wrong. I loved it. Whether or not, when I first started teaching, it was down in Bradford, in Keighley, and then Bradford. And you know, coming from the Northeast, my understanding of rugby league, there was nothing like rugby league up there. Yeah. It was all football, football, football. So yeah. that was certainly something to embrace, this delight of working alongside people from Bradford Bulls, et cetera, and Keithley Cougars. But in terms of on a practical level, I think as a young teacher, I think I failed to realise that people don't necessarily share your values and a love of PE. Mm. And I'm not just talking about that moment when you like open the PE cupboard and it's an absolute mess. It's a case of like, you know, you sometimes saw teachers looking for excuses not to do PE. And that's kind of like understandable because it's all about their own experiences of PE as a child, as an adult, or as a trainee teacher. Yeah. And I think since those early days of naive optimism and enthusiasm, I think I've learned then to become a little bit more empathetic to the needs of others.
Yeah, fair enough. It's one of those, it comes with time and experience, doesn't it? Definitely. So from that one then to, you know, set the tone right from the start, can you, because there is, as we both know, a big difference between PE, physical education, and the main topic that, you know, you're an expert in and the main topic of conversation today, which is physically active learning. Can you explain to our listeners exactly what physically active learning is, and also what it definitely is not?
I'll start off with what it definitely is not. So here's a tale. So as I say, I was a deputy head teacher and acting head teacher. I'm still a member of the NAHT, the National Association of Head Teachers. So a few years ago, we were asked to present a motion at National Conference. So we were there in Liverpool, and all these school leaders were in the auditorium with their voting panels, their Padlets. And we said that physically active learning was going to be a pretty cool thing to look at in terms of a solution for health and education. And we were really fortunate in that 9 out of 10 head teachers and school leaders said that they would look at signposting their members towards PAL solutions. And then the Independent did an article on it, and it was pretty cool, but the Telegraph was not so cool because Right. Their headline, whether or not it was mischievous or not, it was certainly misleading because their headline in the Telegraph was, "Let them run around the classrooms, head teachers urged." And I'm going like, did I say that? No, I didn't. Did Ian say that? No, he didn't. And so I did. I made the unfortunate mistake of looking at all of the online comments on the Telegraph. And I was called an idiot, insane. The best one was a man who is the epitome of everything that's wrong with the education system. Mm-hmm. So I take that as a badge of honor. So it is definitely not running around the classroom. Okay. So with Tagtivate, my version of active learning was a physical challenge or a series of physical challenge followed by thinking challenges. And the next iteration was kind of like a blend between moving and learning, a blend of movement and learning. And as I say, I've since started working with Ian Holmes and set up a community interest company called Move and Learn. And we've reached our own definition, and it's, you know, it's probably a work in progress. We might change it next week. But the current definition that we've got is a learning sequence that can directly or indirectly incorporate an appropriate type of physical activity that enhances the learner's development. And you've got to consider, like, when is it going to be used? And actually, when is being able to sit actually more purposeful for the learner? So to me, it's not, you know, it's not necessarily moving and learning. It's sort of like there's more to it than that. And you've got to think about it in terms of when you integrate movement, the learner needs to benefit more than they would in a traditional sedentary method. So it could be, you know, you've got to think about, will this have an impact on improving academic attainment? And you've also got to think in terms of like the wider benefits. Are we going to be able to improve the focus, improve the engagement, and improve the enjoyment and well-being of the children? And I think that's what physically active learning does. It improves focus, it improves engagement, and it improves enjoyment and wider well-being.
Brilliant. I think that's summarized really nicely there. And the one thing that always comes up in conversation when I'm speaking to schools about Maths on the Move, for example, which is, you know, another physically active learning program, is actually the relationship between the pupil has with the subject, and the you know, not just the confidence, but also the relationship. So there are some pupils that are disengaged by, you know, we always say, oh, were you more of a maths person or English person in school? You know, it's a common conversation. But whether it's English or maths or another subject, it's people can sometimes have this disengagement with the subject. It's, oh, we're going to do maths, and that mental barrier is there. And something that we found, something that I always talk to schools about, is actually, like you said, those wider impacts of if we can strengthen little Sarah's relationship with maths as a subject in school from an early age, that's going to benefit Sarah's learning journey for the rest of her educational career. And it might be a case of, you know, we're not saying they're going to do a session of Tag Today, a session of Math on the Move. So, you know, and there's others out there as well. And after that one session, they're going to be fantastic at maths. That's not necessarily what it's about. It's about they're going to go, they may go back to the classroom and feel more confident to put their hand up and answer a question where before they'll be dodging the teacher's eyesight and glances at any which way they can. From the Tagtivate perspective, a move and learn perspective, have you found that actually the not just the engagement, but the positive relationship with the subject is something that's seen over time as well?
Definitely. I was working with Leicester City and their football foundation 2 years ago, and we just did a quick 45-50 minute session. It was with 20 children, and these were deemed hard to reach children, and we had 20 of them in a relatively small hall. But I always remember this look on this lad's face at the end of the session, a lad called Ethan, year five, and he had like sweat on his brow and a big smile on his face, and he said, you know, I used to think I was rubbish at maths, but now I know I'm not. And I just thought that was worth that, you know, 4 hour drive all the way down to Leicester and back, just for that response alone. And that response is replicated time and time and time again when you work with children and teachers and you see the active learning sessions in action.
Brilliant.
And again, the other thing that we've got to think and be mindful of is like people's perceptions about not just physically active learning, but physical activity in its widest sense. Mm. And we often talk about, you know, the 60-minute target and 30 minutes in school and 30 minutes at home. But we also need to think in terms of the varied type of physical activity across the week. So, you know, different types of physical activity that will develop the movement skills and the muscles and the bones. But crucially, I think more importantly now than ever before, is how do we reduce sedentary time? How do we break up the long periods of sitting with activity? So we can do physical active learning in the classroom, not necessarily running around the classroom, of course, but you can do it purposefully by linking in the maths lesson to some movement or the English lesson with movement, etc.
I completely agree. It's sometimes it's flipping that mindset and sense of, right, how do I fit in an hour of physically active learning to the timetable and actually go, no, let's start with reducing the, you know, the sedentary time, and just look at general physical activity throughout the day. And that leads quite nicely on to something else I wanted to ask you about today. Aside from physical active learning, what are your thoughts about the general physical activity of pupils in primary schools and actually tracking their physical activity? Is that something you'd encourage? Do you think it's necessary? Is there something we can learn from this? And is there something that actually can benefit the teachers from doing this?
Oh, good question. In terms of, okay, so there are various adults, myself included, who register with Strava. And I like to see, you know, that completed ring, etc. And I was working with children yesterday at a school over in Brighouse, and one of the year six girls had a Fitbit, and we were comparing how many steps we were doing. And, you know, it works for certain children, but it won't work for all. I know the guys, the team at Moki, with their wearable technology, I think that's gorgeous in terms of it produces charts and diagrams and graphs that show where the peaks and the spikes of physical activity are, and it shows trends over time. But I'll come back to a friend of mine who works in the NHS, and she said, Bryn, it was a reference to obesity. She said, Bryn, you don't need to measure, you just need to look. And I think sometimes we get fixated by measurement and technology. And sometimes we just need to like have a look at the children and see how they're responding. And as I say, technology and counting and measuring, it'll work for certain children and teachers and school leadership teams. But is it all necessary? I don't know.
No, I suppose then it's the question of necessity against tracking and proving what's happening, because that's the main thing, as you said, when things move to data driven, which everything is heavily data driven in schools, as we know, is it a trap, as it were, that physical activity and sport might be falling into, that we're naturally tracking everything that's happening in a data format, which is great to show impact. It's always fantastic to show impact, you know, and then people might flag up flaws in the sense of, well, actually, Mr. Smith's opinion on looking at these children will be different to Mrs. Jones's opinion looking at these children. And then it becomes really, really subjective rather than objective. And it's a case of, well, how good is, you know, qualitative against quantitative? And then you start opening that kind of worms.
Yeah. And it comes back to what, you know, I was talking about pupil progress meetings, and we were sitting there looking at the data. But behind all that data was a story. Between each number was a child. And the teacher would know that child in terms of family circumstances, things that were going on at home, etc. And it was that justified the numbers. So there was always a story behind the numbers. And I think teachers and school leaders just need to make sure that we have that time to look at the stories as well as the data. Not excuses, but reasons.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, so to make a link back to, because we were talking about, briefly, we were talking about the data, we mentioned about maths, we mentioned about English. It's common now for people to compare PE to maths and English, in the sense of maths and English are core subjects, PE needs to be a core subject, but they're seen as two very different things. Is there... or are there any myths about maybe the differences between the subjects, such as maths and English and PE? You know, because there seems to be this gulf in difference between them. It might be in importance or complexity or anything on those lines. Do you see PE as level with English and maths, or do you think there are differences? Or
So the first round of research that I did was with Dr. Andy Daly Smith, who was then working with Leeds Beckett University.
Yeah.
And on the back of that first round of research in Tagtivate, we were asked to do a TEDx talk. So we actually went down to Norwich and presented our talk, 12 minutes, and we thought we would illustrate it with stage props. So we had these boxes built with printed on them. So we had big boxes with maths and English and smaller boxes with the arts and PE on. And we talked about the fact that subjects A don't need to be taught in separate boxes. And also we asked the audience, like, why are some boxes bigger than others? And why do certain subjects, boxes such as PE and the arts, get shunted to one side? And, you know, again, we ask that question, and we need to ask that question again and again and again. I mean, we all want children to be like numerate and literate with a love of reading, not just like to pass a spelling test or to understand comprehension, but we want children to have a genuine love of reading. But likewise, we don't want that to happen at the expense of well-being. And I'm talking about well-being in its biggest sense, in terms of like physical well-being as well as emotional well-being.
Yeah.
And I do think it comes back to what you said before about like different drivers for children, certain children liking different subjects over other subjects. And when I was a teacher and a school leader, one of my gurus, one of my heroes, and he still is, an advisor called Mick Waters, and he kept on talking about, let's make learning irresistible. And I go back to that, about how do we make learning irresistible, not just for the children, but for the teachers as well.
Yeah, and that's it, because if you've got the teachers enthused about things, obviously they're the ones disseminating the information to the pupils, and they've got to cover in primary schools absolutely everything. And the way that children engage with certain subjects better, you know, adults are the same, teachers are the same. But if we've got if they've got what they need, that might be time, it might be resources, it might be support, whatever it is, to be enthusiastic about what they're teaching and have the energy to push it, the impact on the children is going to be, it's going to be tenfold, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
So looking at that impact and how we get that into schools, because again, we spoke about earlier thinking, oh, how do I squeeze an hour of physical active learning into a school? And you mentioned about actually flipping it and just looking at removing the sedentary time. students. So going back to that mindset and how we can actually take, you know, give our listeners some gems of what they can take away and try and do. What do you think, or what have you found are the most common obstacles for schools to implement and deliver a strong physically active curriculum for their pupils, and how do they overcome these obstacles?
In the old days, I'm thinking of that old Peter Kay sketch, wasn't it, with the dinner ladies putting their hands out. It's spitting, get them inside. I think the weather does have an impact, especially in the UK. So I know, for example, tags and water are all right. Tags and water are brilliant. The tags are waterproof, but tags and wind, never a good mix. You know, like doing a session outside in certain parts of the country and the wind takes hold of the tags and the tags get scattered all over the place. So the weather certainly impacts in terms of active learning. I think time as well. Time is precious. Where there are untold demands upon teachers. So time comes into it. Curriculum constraints, they're linked into that one. Accountability underneath the current inspection framework, the testing framework, Ofsted as well. I think a common one is behaviour, because the perception of teachers and school leaders is if they're not sitting down, they're more likely to be disruptive and misbehave. You know, there's that. I do think back in terms of, like, if you look back at initial teacher training and ongoing CPD, I think the reason why I get invited into so many schools is to provide that quality CPD. And if we had really good quality ITT provision in the first place so that teachers were empowered to take the learning beyond the classroom walls, I think I'd be redundant. So definitely, I think we need better ITT training. In terms of the behaviour, you know, there's this thing that I said about it. Yes, there will be moments if you do an active learning session and the kids, it does become a little bit chaotic at the start, but out of chaos comes order. But if you become, if it's established in the expectations and the routines through your school behaviour policy or your classroom's expectations and routines, the movement in the lessons just becomes another instruction. So you just get the children to listen carefully so they know what we're doing and why we're doing it. I think UF have to emphasize that the movement in the lessons is non-contact. I think you have to emphasize that the movement is always purposeful and it's always calm. And that lessons, I think children need to understand that there are moments whereby learning involves sitting down and movement, and they are both equal opportunities to learn.
Such one of those, you mentioned about curriculum restraints. And you know, we all know there's teachers have got to teach that year's curriculum, and they've got to get through that year because that's the underpinning learning for the following year. And then again, it all leads to SATs. Isn't physical active learning an opportunity to be implemented across the curriculum though? So wouldn't that break down that obstacle?
Oh, definitely. As I say, the research into the Tagtivate program showed that we were looking at fluency and accuracy in mathematics, and you know those gains achieved by the children who took part in the active learning session, as opposed to the children in the sedentary sessions, they were small, they were marginal. But as we know, in terms of Team Sky and marginal gains, those marginal gains become substantial over time.
Yeah,
and I do think, you know, the schools that have started to embrace physically active learning, they're seeing improvements not just in terms of the attitude towards the subjects, but also in terms of the outcome as well. And I'm sure your guys with Maths on the Move have seen similar evidence in the research that Jade Lynn Morris has done.
Yeah, and that's something that we did do a webinar with Andy Daly Smith as well on that one, and the report is out there. And it's definitely something that's definitely one of the key takeaways from that study. And I think that's a clear message that people need to understand is physically active learning is something that it's not one bird one stone, especially not for me. It's a case of, and you mentioned it before, the wider impact that physical active learning can have can help solve a number of things in school development plans, in the targets, and it needs to be seen as that tool.
For sure, we keep on talking about this difference between education versus health, whereas I think with physically active learning, you've got a chance to combine the two. So you've got education and health going hand in hand.
Definitely, definitely. And looking at education and health, and looking at the three areas in school of PE, school sport and physical activity, and making sure, you know, we do understand they are three different areas and they can be used in different ways. I think I know the answer to this, but I just want you to kind of put it across in your own way. But what importance do you place, and did you place when you were a member of SLT in schools on PE, school sport, physical activity? And was there a moment that really triggered that importance for you?
As I say, it was that relentless sitting down, going through people progress meetings, and I understand why we had to do it. And then we would report to governing bodies. But ultimately, it was just that relentless hamster wheel.
Yeah.
Of we'd reach the end of that academic year and then we'd start again. And, you know, these children were being, you know, the numbers were being crunched and crunched and crunched. And I think that was it in terms of here we go again. It's another school year and we're going to go through the same things again and again. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to look back on life and think that's all I've ever done. So nobody gets into teaching to make money. Nobody leaves teaching to make money, I hasten to add. But I do look back and think I had a great time teaching, great time working alongside colleagues, but I wish I'd done the physically active learning approaches and routes earlier in life.
Yeah, and how do you think it would have been accepted back then amongst your colleagues when you first set out? If you were, you know, if you had the knowledge you have now with regards to physical active learning and you tried to introduce it into school, how do you think it would have been received?
With skepticism. and understandably so. You know, you look in terms of any innovation that comes on board, you've got the skeptics, but then you've got the early adopters, and you have to build on those early adopters, and you listen to the skeptics. I always remember talking with an advisor in Bradford at LEA Bradford, and she talked about dinosaurs, and she said, you've got to remember what happened to the dinosaurs. They became extinct, and that kind of like was a bit of a kickstart for me in terms of, yeah, maybe I don't need to listen to the negative voices as much as I do. Maybe I need to think of those one positive voice or that one positive voice, listen to them rather than the echo chamber of the negativity.
Yeah, and, you know, I think we're, as humans, hardwired to listen to the negatives first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been to many, many talks, you know, many keynote speakers that have played that trick on you and made you think of certain things, do certain things, and at the end the things that you remember that stick out are normally the negative things, and it's really hard to train yourself not to focus on those. It's social media, you know, you look at the negatives. Mm-hmm. like you said about the newspaper articles, and you really briefly said that one was fantastic, but this one wasn't very good, there were these comments, and naturally went back to reflecting on the negative. So it is really difficult. So
I'm just thinking about those negative comments that I read with the idiot, insane, etc. You mentioned Dr. Andy Daly Smith. He actually went on board online and answered every single negative comment, every single criticism with science and research, and not a single person came back to him. So there you go. There was a positive outcome from all those negative comments.
And this is where data and proof comes in back in as the positive, doesn't it? Because it, I suppose, then proves to the skeptics, and like you said, you just mentioned about the skeptic, it proves to those skeptics what's going on and why. The important thing is the why, and it's a positive thing that we're talking about. It's a positive thing that we're trying to engage schools in. So, you know, I asked the question about back then, how would it be received? And we're talking about how we get schools to engage with it now. So thinking about our listeners for this podcast, people are listening to get these gems. People are listening for new ideas to bring things into their school. And we might have some advocates for physical active learning that are coming up against obstacles. We might have people that are learning about physical active learning for the first time and think this sounds brilliant. So how would you, in today's day and age, if you were SLT, or even if you were a PE lead, should we say, trying to work with SLT to get physical active learning into school right now, how would you go about making it, you know, part of really the heart of the school?
Well, I would certainly get that initial advocate to share the research and to show examples of where it's working in other schools. Mm. If you could get it on board, it has to be included in the school improvement plan, the school development plan, and it has to be actions as well as words. Mm. You know, they're quite often, you know, the words go on the school improvement plan, but there's not genuine time to implement and then genuinely reflect on it. So I definitely think that if you want active learning or an increase in physical activity, you've got to include it on your school improvement plan, and it has to be re-looked at, reimagined on a half-termly basis. Mm. I think school leaders nowadays, you know, they look at certain combi models in terms of the capabilities, the opportunities, and the motivation which brings about behavior change. Yeah. And I always think in terms of like with move and learn in particular, not necessarily tagged it with move and learn, we have to look at the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is about hearts and minds and changing the culture and the ethos. And then we can do the movement and learning in different environments, whether or not it's in the hall or the corridors or the classrooms or the playground or the field or the forest. But I think we'll need to look in terms of different approaches using different resources, whether or not it's maths on the move or English on the move or tagtivate or, you know, cross-curricular orienteering or anything. Mm. We have to look at those different resources that are out there. But ultimately, we need to think about how do we get buy-in from everybody. And I think to do that, you have to look in terms of combi models and behavioural change models. So you think in terms of what are the capabilities of my teachers in terms of physical capabilities or psychological capabilities to take things forward. You've got to think about their own motivations in terms of what do they believe in, what are their values, what are their beliefs, and also the opportunities that you give your teachers. You know, are your opportunities constrained by the social environment or the physical environment? I definitely think it's not just a quick fix. There are quick fixes there, but ultimately it's about a bigger picture. And, you know, it's about long-term trajectory. We have to play the long-term game. And I'm quoting Ryan Ellis from the PE umbrella there. We have to think about the trajectory rather than the quick win.
Yeah. And that's to make any, you know, substantial, significant and sustainable change, it's never going to be a quick win. It's going to be embedded over time, and which takes a lot of time and effort, which might be a barrier to people that are really enthused about doing it. So like you said, there are quick wins out there to get it started, to see some impact, have some impact on the pupils. But to have that sustainable impact, a lot of people, a lot of previous guests, Helen Batterley, for example, always talking about getting SLT on board, getting the head teacher on board and working with them. If you know, if you're a PE lead, or if you're an early years lead, or you know, if you're a class teacher that has got this enthusiasm, getting them on board. With how much subject leads have got to do, as well as class teaching, throw a random question at you now. What are your thoughts about having a, you know, physically active learning lead in school? Because that's not PE, and again, we've got to make sure we've got this we distinguish what it is and what it is not. It's not PE. What are your thoughts about someone, you know, identifying someone to lead on that, or is that more of a personal choice?
Oh, I mean, I've seen certain. I mean, I'm really fortunate to work with certain schools, and they've looked at physically active learning champions or move and learn champions. But it's not just one person within school; it's small teams within school. So it could be specifically for maths, it could be specifically for English, or it could be broken down into different key stages. So I definitely think those savvy school leaders who incorporate devolved leadership, they probably get the most out of it by giving middle leaders or, you know, that maybe younger teachers a chance to lead in a subject that's not necessarily historically deemed high priority. But I definitely think that the chances for doing evidence-based research in schools is phenomenal. Yeah, so if you've got the capacity to do so, do try like small team-based approaches and pilot ideas and pilot programs and learn from those mistakes.
Brilliant. I mean, I think there's some good gems to take away there, again, for our listeners of how do I do this first. And I think recapping on some of those, it's evidence in what's happening in other schools in the area. It's looking to get SLT on board. It's looking to become that champion or create those champions in school. So there's a few gems there, which is fantastic.
And it's so, not just the adults, you know, if it's the children as well. You know, that yesterday I did a session with a school in Brighouse, and we started off with year six, and out of the class of 30, six were chosen to be the Move and Learn champions of Tagtivate leaders for the day. And those kids weren't necessarily gifted and talented or sport leaders. They were the kids that may be lacking a little bit of self-esteem or self-confidence. But, they were amazing. Their people skills by the end of the session, at the end of the day, they were virtually leading the sessions without support from myself. And I think we definitely need Move and Learn champion children to maybe nudge Miss and say, Miss, we've not done the active learning session for today. Yeah. And then, you know, it's listening to the voices of the children. I think sometimes children are underestimated in terms of their capabilities and their creativity and their leadership skills.
Yeah, so it's very easy if you're a teacher and you've got X to get through, and it might be a very difficult stage of learning for those in your classroom. It might be a new method or concept within English or maths or something else. It can be very easy to get wrapped up in time and run out of time. Whereas to have that external prompt of a child saying Miss or Sir. We've not moved. To actually have that prompt and think, okay, let's do a 5-minute movement break. And again, it goes back to that, not just physically active learning, but actual just some physical activity and remove the sedentary style, and start to break that down. I've not thought about that before, about having children championing it. I've always thought about teachers or subject leaders championing it.
I saw something on Twitter with Neil McAvoy, who I think is a school leader up there in Hartlepool, and he talks about 30-30, and we talked about the 30 minutes of activity at home, 30 minutes at school, but he has this thing whereby children aren't allowed to sit down for longer than 30 minutes. And I was thinking, that's a really cool idea. I wish I'd thought of it. But what about the children who are actually engaged and engrossed in their learning?
Yeah.
Used to say that you have to stop their learning then, stand up, do a dance, do a movement. I'm not sure. So I think as a teacher, you know full well when you're the energy levels might be flagging, and then it's a case of we need to break up the sedentary time that way. When it's the natural time to do it, you can sense the mood in the room, and you know full well that, you know, now is the time to just break it up, have that brain energizer.
Yeah, and again, it goes back to teachers seeing and feeling how the children are doing, the impact on it, rather than it being a data-driven, strictly scripted what's going on. And it's that fine balance of having both, isn't it? Data for impact to show it is improving what's going on with children, so we need to continue it, make it more widespread, but also listening to and reacting to the children to make sure, like you said, it's not actually having a negative impact on disengagement and interruption of learning and so on. Now, you've been in the physical active learning world for quite a while. So, you know, the landscape changes from the top, from the government to on the ground and everywhere in between. So since starting Tagtivate, since starting your focus on physical active learning and that whole field, What changes have you seen during that time that might be encouraging, or, you know, that it might be a case of actually what you started out with is very different to what it is now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you just have to look on social media. You have to look out there. There's more discussion and more awareness on physically active learning and the need for active, more physical activity in schools than ever before. You've got to look towards the growing body of evidence, national and international. You know, I've got a slide that I share from the World Health Organization, and it was at the start of last year, and it talks about the fact that the World Health Organization recognizes that physical activity has an impact on enhancing academic achievement at schools. So we know that the research demonstrates that it works as well as it plays, and it's not a gimmick. And we've already referenced, you know, Dr. Andy Daly-Smith. We've got Jade Lynn Morris, and they're sharing our work as well. They're, I'm really fortunate in terms of the first round of research by Andy has led to funding for Dr. Liam Hill and Shania Boom at Leeds University to take on board further research using a larger cohort over a longer period of time. And here's an example for you. You know, when I said in terms of the negative comments, a man who's an idiot, a man who's insane, a man who's the epitome of everything that's wrong with the world in education. Well, one of the criticisms was, it's a man with a book to sell. Well, funnily enough, Ian and I were then commissioned to write a book about active learning. So later on this year, we have a book coming out about active learning through the wonderful team at Crown House. So we would never have been given that opportunity X years ago, but now it's on the radar. And I think it's not just on the radar of teachers and school leaders. I think it's on the radar of parents too.
That's fantastic. It's obviously ironic how everything turns out. But it's fantastic that people that aren't necessarily driving it, like, you know, like you are and others around the country, are recognising that more people need to hear about this and actually coming to you to commission you to write a book, which is absolutely fantastic. So, yeah, everyone, keep your eyes peeled for that book hitting the shelves or hitting Amazon or wherever we may find it. That'd be fantastic. We've gone through quite a lot, and you've already given some absolute gems, which is great. And it's really interesting to hear the differences from when you started and throughout your career, throughout your journey, into how things are now. So coming back to right now, right this second, to our listeners who want to engage their children in more physical activity, who want to incorporate physical active learning in their schools and need to evidence it to their SLT and get things started in their schools. What are your top five tips for our listeners to take away? They may be, you know, the teams or the individuals influencing PE, school sport and physical activity in schools, primary schools, to support them in embedding that top-down physically active ethos in their school. Top five tips that they can take away from you.
Okay. I think there's some great stuff going on there. About 2 years ago, I was part of the initial team that got together to look at the Creating Active Schools framework.
Yes.
I would certainly reference the website and hopefully you can put that in the notes for this podcast so we can signpost people towards the Creating Active Schools framework, which I think is certainly definitely worthwhile looking at. Across in Europe, we've got Activate Your Classroom EU, a free resource. And again, I would look at that because there's some great takeaway ideas there to maybe start the conversations going. Mm-hmm. We've talked as well about, you know, we've talked about maths on the move, we've talked about English on the move, Tagtivate, Move and Learn, even, you know, people like the PE Passport, they've got their own active learning programs coming to the fore. We've got Teach Active, as we well know, they're out there. You've got to look towards those proven evidence-based research programs that are out there already. They're there to help you so you're not starting from scratch. But ultimately, you need to put into why do you want to do it? Why do you want to do it in your school? And once you've realized why you want to do it, put it on your school development plan, put those words into action and genuinely give it time to reflect upon. The other thing is just to accept the fact that mistakes will be made, but be brave, have fun. And we referenced marginal gains before becoming substantial over time. Ian and I often talk about small steps make a big difference over time. And the other thing is we've alluded to it in terms of Move and Learn champions. Listen to your children. I mean, to me, why do we teach? It's for the benefit of the children, and we need to get them involved, not just pupil voice, but pupil action as well.
Brilliant. I
wasn't counting there. Was that five? Was
you know more? What? I've been writing down notes and I've lost count myself as well, but I've been scribbling away furiously because they're absolutely fantastic. So thank you for sharing those. Whether that was 3, 4, 5, 7, 9, or 10, I don't know. But I think there's some definite gems in there for all of our listeners, which is brilliant. And you've obviously been dropping gems throughout the whole episode, which is great. So thank you very much for everything you've shared. Like I said, listeners, keep your eyes and ears peeled and clear for the book that's coming out. I did mention that we'd done a physical active learning webinar as well. That's on the Aspire Ed platform, which is aspire-ed.co.uk. There's lots of free webinars on there on the free memberships area, which is the Discover membership. But there's also paid memberships so I have greater access. But like you said, Bryn, it's a case of looking around, seeing what's out there, seeing what works for the school. And we had this conversation actually before recording, didn't we? In the sense of there's subtle differences between everything that's out there. And one program, even though it's physical active learning, might not be 100% correct for your school. And it's based on your needs. And it goes back to, like you said, putting it in the school development plan. Why is it in the school development plan? What are you aiming to achieve with it? And if that's clear, in your head, and it's on black and white, and it's in the school development plan of why we're doing this and what we want to achieve, that should help really narrow down when you're doing, when all of our listeners are doing their research into what they want to look to implement, if it's going to meet the needs, really.
I always remember an early Tagtivate session with a school leader in Leeds. Mm. And at the end of the Tagtivate session, he said, right, guys, we've had the session. We know what the resources will look like. We know what it feels like to play the games. Stand up if you think we should spend our P and sport premium funding on it. And I looked at the head teacher and went, what is he doing? And then luckily, all the children stood up and like big thumbs up. So, and then better still, he actually put it on the school website. We use Pupil Voice to determine how to spend our PE and sport premium funding, which Ofsted love.
Yeah, this is it. Ofsted love all of that. And it goes back to what we said really early on, actually, in the relationship between the pupils and the subject. If they're enjoying it, if they're engaged with it, it's more likely to be having the impact you want. Mm. Anyway, so to listen to the children is so vital. It's so important to achieve what the school wants to achieve. So, yeah. So thank you very much again, Bryn. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the Prime P Huddle. And like I was saying before we started recording the episode, there'll be more down the line, I'm sure, and there'll be more collaboration to really impact physical active learning. So all the listeners, listen out for Bryn and any further links with ourselves ourselves here at Aspire. But once again, Bryn, thank you so much for your time and your input.
Thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts and ideas, and all the best to the rest of the Aspire team for the rest of 2022, and keep being the force for good that you are.
Thank you very much, Bryn, much appreciated. Thank you all, and hopefully see you soon.
Join us next time for the Primary P Huddle podcast. Remember to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. You can connect with us on Twitter at Aspire Sports UK and find out more about us and the family at www.aspire-sports.co.uk and www.aspire-ed.co.uk.